So the decision to downplay the Democratic vision as a motive for war was basically a marketing choice. Not until well into my time as press secretary did I realize that the dream of a democratic Middle East was actually the most powerful force behind President Bush's drive to war. Time and again, I heard President Bush speaking with obvious passion about the blessings of freedom during his private discussions with world leaders and casual conversations we would have. Every president wants to achieve greatness, but few do. As I have heard Bush say, only a wartime president is likely to achieve greatness, in part because the epical upheavals of war provide the opportunity for transformative change of the kind Bush hoped to achieve. In Iraq, Bush saw his opportunity to create a legacy of greatness. Intoxicated by the influence and power of America, Bush believed that a successful transformation of Iraq could be the linchpin for realizing his dream of a free Middle East. But there is a problem here, which has become obvious to me only in retrospect, a disconnect between the president's most heartfelt objective in going to war and the publicly stated rationale for that war. Bush and his advisors knew that the American people would almost certainly not support a war launched primarily for the ambitious purpose of transforming the Middle East. There has always been a strong isolationist streak in America and a resistance among Americans to committing troops into combat unless absolutely necessary. Most citizens today understand that our superpower status, achieved through our great wealth, our global influence, our military might, and our role as the foremost democracy, means that the United States needs to play a responsible leadership role in the world. But by the same token, we are a peace-loving people who are not interested in global conquest or imperial might. Instead, we want to take care of our own interests and needs at home, engaging in peaceful trade and friendly competition with other nations, and using our military strength not to reform other nations, but to protect our own interests and those of our closest allies when they are directly threatened. President Bush understands this attitude and to some extent shares it. That is why he ran for president in 2000 promising a humble foreign policy that would avoid the temptation of nation building and instead focus on the immediate security interest of America. The idea of transforming the Middle East coercively contradicted this promised humility, and it would be very difficult for the president and his administration to sell to the citizens. It would provoke all kinds of debates that might not be easy to win, and that in the aftermath of the invasion of Iraq have now received more attention. Was it realistic to think about transforming a country like Iraq with an entrenched regime from tyranny into democracy, primarily through military force? Were the peoples and civic institutions of Iraq fully ready to support self-rule? What kinds of sustained military presence and intervention would be required to maintain stability during a time of governmental or civil upheaval? What role would Islamic fundamentalism play in the newly constituted regime? What about the long-standing ethnic and religious tensions just below the surface in this tightly controlled country in the region? And how could we be sure that the new democratically elected government in Iraq would be pro-American and ready to live in peace with its neighbor and American ally, Israel? The answers to these questions are not easily addressed and require careful consideration and thoughtful planning. Rather than open this Pandora's box, the administration chose a different path, not employing out-and-out deception, but shading the truth, downplaying the major reason for going to war, and emphasizing a lesser motivation that could arguably be dealt with in other ways, such as intensified diplomatic pressure. Trying to make the WMD threat and the Iraqi connection to terrorism appear just a little more certain, a little less questionable than they were. Quietly ignoring or disregarding some of the crucial caveats in the intelligence, and minimizing evidence that pointed in the opposite direction. Using innuendo and implication to encourage Americans to believe as fact some things that were unclear and possibly false, such as the idea that Saddam had an active nuclear weapons program, and other things that were overplayed or completely wrong, such as implying Saddam might have an operational relationship with Al-Qaeda. When you mount a campaign, you aim at deploying your strongest arguments. It's a bit like the strategy a courtroom lawyer uses. He doesn't worry about acknowledging the holes in his case or the valid points against his own arguments. He leaves that to the lawyers on the other side. Instead, he focuses purely on his most compelling arguments, even if this means presenting a one-sided picture of the case. That's his job. The search for ultimate truth is in other hands, those of the judge and the jury. And that is the spirit in which the Bush administration approached the campaign for war. The goal was to win the debate, to get Congress and the public to support the decision to confront Saddam. In the pursuit of that goal, embracing a high level of candor and honesty about the potential war, its larger objectives, its likely cost, and its possible risks, came a distant second. In part, to lay the groundwork for broadening the war on terror beyond Afghanistan and pursuing coercive democracy in Iraq, the president outlined a new doctrine of preemption during his commencement address at West Point in early June. I accompanied him on the trip. Among other things, Bush said, "The gravest danger to freedom lies at the perilous crossroads of radicalism and technology. When the spread of chemical and biological and nuclear weapons, along with ballistic missile technology, when that occurs, even weak states and small groups could attain a catastrophic power to strike great nations. Our enemies have declared this very intention and have been caught seeking these terrible weapons. They want the capability to blackmail us, or to harm our friends, and we will oppose them with all our power." For much of the last century, America's defense relied on the Cold War doctrines of deterrence and containment. In some cases, those strategies still apply. But new threats also require new thinking. Deterrence, the promise of massive retaliation against nations, means nothing against shadowy terrorist networks with no nation or citizens to defend. Containment is not possible when unbalanced dictators with weapons of mass destruction can deliver those weapons on missiles or secretly provide them to terrorist allies. We cannot defend America and our friends by hoping for the best. We cannot put our faith in the words of tyrants who solemnly sign non-proliferation treaties and then systemically break them. If we wait for threats to fully materialize, we will have waited too long. Homeland defense and missile defense are part of stronger security and they're essential priorities for America. Yet the war on terror will not be won on the defensive. We must take the battle to the enemy, disrupt his plans, and confront the worst threats before they emerge. In the world we have entered, the only path to safety is the path of action, and this nation will act. The New York Times described this address as a toughly worded speech that seemed aimed at preparing Americans for a potential war with Iraq. It was. Just as we'd sought to shape and manipulate sources of public opinion to our advantage in order to pass tax cuts and education reform, and would later do the same in our attempt to transform Social Security. Now, we were setting the conditions for selling military confrontation with Iraq. This doctrine of preemption would become a cornerstone of the White House's new national security strategy that would be released in mid to late September of that same year. Bush was now lowering the bar for engaging in preemptive war, a step that might have been more widely viewed as radical had it occurred prior to 9/11. The doctrine unambiguously stated that while the United States would always proceed deliberately and carefully weigh the consequences of actions, it would not hesitate to use force if necessary to preempt not just an imminent threat, but a grave and gathering one, if need be. It was based on the assumption that waiting for a threat to become imminent before acting would likely mean that we would respond too late. And this new principle, encoded in our new national security strategy, was clearly aimed, in part, at paving the way to removing Saddam Hussein from power by force. Over that summer of 2002, top Bush aides had outlined a strategy for carefully orchestrating the coming campaign to aggressively sell the war. As far as I know, no one objected to the plan. It had consensus support from the president's foreign policy team and senior advisors. In the permanent campaign era, it was all about manipulating sources of public opinion to the president's advantage. Of course, I didn't see it that way at the time. Like most, if not all of those involved, I viewed it as the way things were done to advance the broader agenda, simply part of the way Washington governed. I didn't pause to think about the potential consequences of our campaign to manipulate the public debate. When you're caught up in the intense day-to-day experience of the White House and Washington, your focus is on winning the daily battles, which makes it extremely difficult to step back and have a clear-eyed perspective on the broader meaning of it all. In The Permanent Campaign, contributor Hugh Hecklow writes about the danger of such an approach. Peace and prosperity can deceive, but wartime pressures distill into their clearest essence the dangers of conflating political campaigning and governing. Government-sponsored propaganda campaigns abound under modern conditions of total war. It is disastrous, however, to confuse the propaganda campaign with the realities of the war-making campaign. Failure to govern on the basis of the truths of the situation, as best they can be known, is a sure route to eventual disaster for the governed and rulers alike. History suggests that one major reason the Western democracies were better governed in World War II than their opponents was that their leaders brought their people into the truth of governing the war effort and did not merely campaign to raise morale.